Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. No one knows us like our dogs, goes the old adage. They watch, follow, listen. Our dogs are so connected to us that they sometimes make us wonder, do they know what we're thinking? My guest today says the bond runs much deeper than that. Dogs don't know what we think, he says. They feel what we feel. This hour on Point, humans, dogs, and the dog as emotional mirror. You can join the conversation. How connected are you to your dog? Can you read its emotions? Do you see it reading yours, changing yours? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from London is author and dog trainer Kevin Behan, an expert in the rehabilitation of aggressive and problem dogs. He runs Natural Dog Training, a clinic in Vermont. He's written extensively on dog training techniques. His new book is Your Dog is Your Mirror, The Emotional Capacity of Our Dogs and Ourselves. Kevin Behan, welcome to On Point. Great to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's my pleasure to be here.
So, a mirror, an emotional mirror. And I guess my first question is there's a lot here. I'm reading it, but lay out what's new here. I mean, they say a dog is man's best friend. Friendship has a lot to do with emotion. Don't we know this?
In one way, we do. The way I like to sum it up is everything we think about dogs is wrong, but everything we feel about dogs is right. And my mission is to parse apart the thinking from the feeling. So what we do that's wrong from my point of view is read thoughts and intention into their behavior. And if we were to step back from that and understand their behavior purely as an emotional mirror of their surroundings, and emotion is a mirror, I think that's where our understanding will finally arrive at, then we'll see that they're actually reflecting every emotional component of their group, and the number one component of their group is their owner.
Maybe you can lay it out for us, your perspective on this, in contrast to a couple of models that I think people know well. We talk about dogs maybe every couple of years. I mean, dogs are great. But we talked a couple of years ago to Cesar Millan, who people know from his TV show, and he does a lot with his sort of dominance model. And who's the boss when the dog is in the house? On the other hand, there's this sort of what training and reinforcement, positive reinforcement approach. How does your perspective reflect on or off of those? Is it different, Kevin?
Yeah, it's different. What's interesting to say about the dominance approach is that in a very crude way, it is speaking to the mirror. So if you act dominant, your dog acts submissive. But if we weren't to read thoughts into that, we would see more clearly that the dog is just being the opposite of the owner. It's just being an emotional mirror. And from my background as a protection dog trainer, police service dog trainer, we recognize in the field that states of dominance and submission are really states of insecurity, emotional insecurity, and we never promote those. And so that kind of work led me to abandon the dominance model, which is really just trying to tell the dog not to have enough energy. And in my model, I always want the dog to have lots of energy, because if it's channeled properly, it always comes out with sociability. So you could say the dominance model is kind of mechanical. It sees the dog as an instinctual robot. If you're dominant, it will be submissive like a machine. And then the other side, you have the learning model, the scientific principles of learning. But it sees the dog more as a learning machine, that it's almost like a blank slate. It doesn't really give much attention to the emotional dynamic that actually runs the dog from my point of view. And it believes that everything is a function of reinforcement and acquired meaning through experience. And what I learned from my work, especially with service dogs, is that nature has a very distinct order, and dogs innately pick this up. And the variation in their responses depends on how free-flowing their emotion is. When they're shut down, then they concentrate on the negative things. But when they're open and flowing, they concentrate on the positive things. And this is why, in my model, emotion is always social when it's allowed to work its magic.
So when you say, and it's right there in the title, your dog is your mirror, does that mean if I'm if my dog is a mess, I'm a mess? If my dog is happy and well-behaved, I'm happy and on an even keel?
Well, on the deepest level, which is really what fascinates me, I like to use the metaphor of a emotional seesaw. So if we could only see one party on the seesaw, then and we couldn't see the other, we could nevertheless know what the invisible party is experiencing based on the one we can see. So if you really look at people who are very up and positive, but it may not be emanating from their deepest core, you'll see their dog might be withdrawn and even aggressive. It's showing us what we don't see about that person. So, I'll take myself as an example. A lot of people see me as a very positive and up kind of person because my personality's like that.
Mm-hmm.
But in my book, I lay out quite strongly that my nature is exactly the opposite, and that's what I began to see in my dogs, that they were showing the side of me that I didn't want anybody to see. One quick example comes to mind. I was working with a gentleman who was a rebel in the educational field,
okay. And
he had the calmest dog on earth, and then his educational business got very successful, and he was going to meetings and wearing suit and tie, and his dog became crazy. His next dog became crazy. And it was very interesting how when he flipped modalities, his dog, he had the opposite kind of dog as his invisible partner on the seesaw.
So I hear you saying that even if we're up and positive on the surface and appear to have it together, if we don't deep down, the dog will see that. So it really does come back, the way you're describing it, to the same thing. If our dog is a mess, however you want to describe that, are you really saying that that means that its owner, deep down in their deepest self, is conflicted, a mess, some a deep problem is being exposed here?
Yeah, on a deepest level, in their animal makeup, and that's the way our very viscera responds, there's something very profound going on there. And the dog is a wonderful window to things that we're not even aware of. And it's really fascinating to me, the research that's now being done on emotion, and in particular the enteric nervous system that's been dubbed the little brain in the gut. And it's having profound emotional experiences, and we are consciously unaware of these. And my premise is, which fits my model beautifully, is that the dog is tuning into that very deep visceral response we're having, and then he's mirroring it in his actions. So his actions are bringing to the surface what we're feeling deep, deep down, but are actually unaware of.
You go all the way back to a deep evolutionary explanation for this. You go back all the way to the wolf pack. Take us to the roots of what you're describing here as you see it.
Yeah, again, through my work with police dogs, which is really a wonderful way to get inside the canine hunting impulse, it finally became clear to me that when I traced it back, that wolves hunt by feel. They're physically inferior to their main prey, a defensive herd of buffalo and a monstrous, powerfully animals such as the moose. 10 wolves are no match for one pugnacious moose. And so they have to feel which animal is vulnerable, which one's losing its nerve. And once they do, they synchronize around that one and they act as one.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're hunting by feel, and they're developing an emotional, I call it emotional sonar. It's kind of akin to the acoustical sonar of dolphins, where they put out a ping and they get back a reading from an object, an acoustical signature of it. Well, that's what wolves are doing. They're putting out a ping, an emotional ping, and then feeling what the animal is doing with that kind of pressure. And then when we look at the domestication process, it becomes really clear that early man's interest had to be primarily about the hunt. We just look at the names of all the breeds that we live with: Golden Retrievers, Labrador Retrievers, German Shepherds. It's herding of sheep. Sheep are the prey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the anatomy of the dog is called a canine. That's the big teeth that seize the prey. Terriers go to earth for the prey. And dachshund means badger dog. We have otter hounds. All the animals.
They hunted together. Man somehow got dog into this relationship where they worked together.
I believe that man and wolf, or proto-dog, proto-wolf, were mm-hmm. hunting the same prey, and somehow they entrained on this common passion. Passion in common equals compassion. And then it was a series of professional experiences when I finally realized that everything was a mirror emotionally. The hunt is a mirror, the prey to the predators as a group mind. This is what we amplified through domestication. We didn't tamp down that heart of the wolf. We actually amplified it. And that's why they can read us through their emotional sonar. That's very heightened. So whatever we feel, they pick it up. And then their job is to get energy moving. This is how the animal mind works. It is deathly afraid of stagnant energy. So when energy is stuck, it wants to get its moving. So if we're carrying around stuck energy and it's a denied emotion from early in our lives, they infallibly read this, and their mission is to get this moving. And as I like to say, what else is a best friend for?
I mean, you make the dog sound like the ultimate Sigmund Freud or therapist or something, seeing us more deeply than we see ourselves. You say it's not an accident that dogs and humans got together. Humans as what you describe the most emotional species, and dogs as this deeply deep emotion readers.
Right. Well, I think early man was on the same evolutionary track. They were attracted to a prey that was physically superior to them. And I mean, when we think about early man hunting with rocks and spears and very primitive weapons, and they went after woolly mammoths and amazing prey animals that were capable of crushing them. And so I think this is the same emotional track, evolutionary track of developing a high emotional capacity to feel what other feels. And they had to hunt as a group and know what everybody was going to do before they did it. They had to feel it, sort of like a team working at peak efficiency. They begin to feel what everybody's going to do and anticipate it. And, you know, it's really fascinating. I remember the Discovery Channel ran a special on the Aborigines of Australia in the Bay of Eden were hunting whales, and the killer whales drove them in, and they developed a covenant of the tongue where they hunted the same prey that neither could get on their own.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the human-dog emotional connection with dog trainer and near-dog philosopher Kevin Behan, long-time dog trainer, well-known for his work in the training front. And he's thought a lot about the dog, the canine, and the human. His new book is Your Dog is Your Mirror, The Emotional Capacity of Our Dogs and Ourselves. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Kevin runs the Natural Dog Training Program in Vermont. He joins us today from London. He's out on the hoof. And Kevin, lots of response here online. Edwina says, my dog is like one of my children, the best behaved one. Marianne says, her dog reads me like a book. Sometimes I feel us moving like you see birds flying together. An unspoken energy ties us. There's your word, Kevin. It moves us in tandem through our days. It's lovely, she says. Lynn says, training my dog has taught me more about myself than any other single experience in my life. And in that, I include marriage and motherhood. And then popular you, Jerry, says, Kevin Behan saved my dog and also our relationship. He was my fifth trainer. Thanks. Thankfully, I didn't give up. Lots of positive response there. Do people get what you're saying intuitively, Kevin? Or do they look at you and say, wait a minute, my dog screwed up and it's not me, it's the dog?
Yeah, no, I believe they do get it intuitively. And it can get kind of technical, but I like to tell them it's so simple that it's hard to get at first. But once you start experiencing, once you start seeing your dog in a new light, all of a sudden, at some point, it hits you like a ton of bricks, and it makes perfect common sense. I was thinking about the emotional sonar I was talking mm-hmm. about earlier.
Yeah.
I mean, look what dogs are doing now to detect epilepsy hours before a seizure, hours before any medical diagnostic machine can pick it up. They're being used now to detect cancer and diabetes. So this is what they're able to do, is project into us and then feel what we feel well before we know it.
Dog training runs in your family. Tell us about your father's work and then your work. And you, as I'm reading here, you didn't exactly come to the same conclusions about dogs.
Right. When I started working with my father, and he got his background in World War II training the dogs for deployment overseas.
He was one of the first in the country to have dog training as a real career.
Exactly. He was on a national radio show such as this, and he was worried that no one would want to talk to him because there were generals that had been in the war, and actually Oppenheimer, who was part of the Manhattan Project. But the audience all wanted to ask him questions about how to get their dog to sit and heal and come when called, rather than they cared about splitting the atom. And so he realized he could make a dog business. And he was a pioneer in his field. He was actually the first one to apply the concept of a dominant hierarchy that we see in wolves to the relationship between a dog and the owner. And when I grew up in the business and became a trainer under his auspices, it made total sense to me. But every so often, things didn't add up. And when I asked and pressed questions, you finally got to dead ends, and science didn't help me with that at all. And finally, I was happy to find the German and European dog training movement, which was much more natural and really introduced me to the idea of the nature of the wolf as it is endures in the makeup of the dog, and how everything about the dog, this led me to see him as an animal that wants to synchronize with his group and therefore becomes a mirror of what is going on within the group.
So talk to us very practically about what your approach, what your perspective means in terms of getting along with the dog. It's not dominance training. It's not positive reinforcement exactly. You're looking at this emotional connection, you know, day in and day out. How could or should that work in a dog and human relationship?
Well, my basic mantra is there's no such thing as bad energy. So when you see the dog doing something bad, instinctively we say, oh, my gosh, this is wild energy, and our instinct is try to control it and repress it. And what I've developed is a series of techniques where I encourage the dog to express more and more energy, the exact opposite of what our instincts are. And the dog starts to feel so released and safe and comfortable that he gives me credit for that. And so he can go from wanting to bite me to wanting to be in harmony with me. And from that mindset, it's very easy to shape him and influence him and lead him to the answer, which is how to be part of a group for the purposes of a collective goal, not just work for the purpose of work or to please anybody. But so something that the dog can put his heart into, and that's why it's so important to understand the hunting evolution of the dog, that's what he can put his heart into. Anything to do with the hunt. For some dogs, it's just going for a car ride. With other dogs, it's chasing a Frisbee, and that's why dogs love agility training, which becomes so popular now. Anything that leads the dog to his goal, that connects him with an owner, that's his number one motivation.
How does that connect him with the owner? I mean, if you're throwing a Frisbee, you're having fun together, that's for sure. But how does that relate back to this emotional connection you're describing?
Well, what's really fascinating is if the owner wants it, then the dog will want it. Now, the genesis of most problem behavior is the owner will tell the dog not to take something, which is actually communicating to the dog how much the owner wants it. So now the dog's nature is inspired to want that forbidden object and even more. This is now misinterpreted as defiance and dominance, possessiveness, and that's not it at all. This dog needs to connect with this object because the owner has invested so much energy into it. And, for example, the number one chewed-up object in households today used to be soft, fluffy slippers. Now it's the TV controller. Because that's everybody focuses on that. So the puppy says, that must be it. That must be the goal. Let me get to it. And, of course, he gets in trouble. And that's just a fundamental misunderstanding between what the owner wants and what the dog wants. And it's up to the owner to merge those together.
A dog feels what we feel, says Kevin Behan. Let's bring our listeners in. Nashville, Tennessee, Jennifer's calling. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air with Kevin.
Oh, hi. Hi, Tom. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Hello, Jennifer.
Thank you for this topic. And first of all, I love the show. I listen every day.
Great.
I was calling because my husband and I actually, our dogs have taught us that we're now ready for children, I think. It's funny because we've had 5 dogs over the course of our relationship. Our first dog, when we were 22 and 23 and dating, and she passed away a couple years ago, but we now have 4 rescue dogs of all different ages.
Wow.
And yeah. Oh, not intentionally. Unplanned dogs, so to speak.
Okay.
It always is.
They are. They find me. Two five-year-old sisters that were found together were puppies, pit bull mixed puppies, and two now one-year-old boys, two different breeds. And we have noticed the difference in the dog behavior based almost mirroring our relationship and the changes and how our relationship has evolved and become more secure and become much more mature and healthy.
When you say our relationship, Jennifer, do you mean when you say our relationship, your relationship with your husband?
Yes, my relationship with my husband.
So as your marriage gets better, your relationship with your dogs has become better as well?
Exactly. And our dogs are better behaved. I think our five-year-old dogs are better adjusted than my dog who passed away, because we call her a teenage pregnancy dog. If we'd had children in our early 20s, that's probably what they would have acted like. And we just feel like they really, our one-and-a-half-year-old male dog that we got a year and a half ago,
mm-hmm.
is our best, most socialized dog. And I think we are in the best place we've been in our relationship. We're married for 7 years now. And we can see the emotional connection in our lives and also our dog kind of reflects that back to us.
It's amazing. Kevin Behan, does it make sense to you? Are we imposing this kind of perception on our dog or our pack of dogs in Jennifer's case? Or does it sound credible?
Oh, yeah, no, it makes perfect sense to me. And it is common sense, ultimately, as Jennifer and her husband have become emotionally softer with each other and more trusting of their deepest feelings, then the dogs are reflecting that as well. So it doesn't all have to be bad. It can be very, very good. And it never ceases to amaze me.
Have you seen other examples of people's emotional life filtering into their relationship with their dog, their emotional life, good or bad?
Of course, yeah. It's always the way it is. You just have to talk with someone for a while. And when they're talking about their dog, they're actually talking about their own heart. And the dog is triggering, in our own psyche, it's triggering our deepest feelings that we're least aware of. So I ask people at my seminars to write down what they like, what they don't like about their dog, and get a narrative going about their dog, why it does this and does that. And what they're actually doing is decoding their own heart. And the dog is not copying them or trying to please them. It's mirroring them on a deep, deep emotional level. It's doing exactly, aligning itself with exactly what they're feeling.
You write that if a dog owner tells you her dog is manipulative, chances are that the owner is manipulative. Is it really that straightforward?
Well, yeah, either the owner is very afraid of being manipulated. Like, for example, as a child, she might have been criticized by her parents for being too manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
And she might have been just innocent and just doing something that was trying to please herself, and she's too young to know better. But she took on that judgment that I'm being manipulative if I do what I want. And so she'll see that in her dog later because she'll take on that judgment. So the dog will act out this tension. And from the dog's point of view, it's just acting out tension that it's picking up in the owner. But then the owner supplies the thoughts in the dog's behavior and sees it as manipulating the situation to get something it wants.
Let's go to Allie. Let's go to Allie, if we may, in Cumberland, Rhode Island. Sorry, Kevin. Allie, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah.
Tom, I have a huge crush on you.
Oh.
I'm very glad to be talking about my dog.
I hope your dog is happy then. Good. What do you know, Allie?
I have the best dogs, two Maltese, but I have to say, three times I have gone into labor. Well, I have three kids, and all three times before the babies came, about 2 weeks ahead of time, my one, the girl Maltese, just totally loses her potty training, and it'll freak me out. I think I've got a new baby coming. What is this dog doing to me? But I think she just feels a major change coming, because the day I come home with the baby, she's just right back to her perfect self.
Wow, so you think she's anticipating, and it's happened three times, so you've got your repeated evidence here, Allie.
I do. Three times, three kids, three experiences.
Allie, thanks for that. Kevin, what do you say? Allie, in Allie's case, it's going into labor. We're hearing a lot lately about dogs sniffing out cancer. What do you make of these stories?
I would go so far to say that the dog is picking up the beginning of contractions and the major changes that in the latest stages of her pregnancy, and it is viscerally upsetting the dog. And not that the dog's having a bad thought about it, it's actually feeling that internal getting ready to go. And that's what it is, regresses the dog back to those earliest experiences.
I mean, this may be something even deeper than emotion. I mean, Ali's not in labor yet, though you may tell me that her own body, her own emotions are anticipating labor. But is emotion really at play here?
I think emotion is as deep as we can go. It's actually arises. I don't believe the theories that it comes out of our higher brain functions or even our lower brain functions. I really think it comes from our viscera. It's cellular, and Damasio's work is even pointing to the beginning of emotion as a homeostatic device in bacterium. So I agree with that. I think it's at the very substrate of consciousness, and so we're having these amazingly intense visceral responses, and yet our intellectual mind, which is very quick and adroit, just glides right over. It doesn't even notice it because we're so busy with our thoughts, and our thoughts are so vivid in our mind that we're not attuned as the animal is to our deeper states. So, for example, when people are sick and feeling really low, the dog actually feels closer to them and comes to their side, and we could say that they're comforting them, but an even deeper understanding from my point of view is the dog actually feels closer because the person is so much more attuned to the deeper level of emotion in their body.
It's interesting. We look at the dogs and think not much going on there. You turn it around and say they're tuned in to what really matters in us as animals, not the laundry list of grocery items to be purchased or, you know, the daily trivia of that make up our days, but what's really going on. Bottom line, the dog's x-raying us, not the other way around. Steve in South Windsor, Connecticut. Steve, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you know?
I have a question for your guest. I'm fairly new to the dog game. I've been doing it for about 3 years now, and I didn't really know anything about dogs before I got my dog.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a blitzkrieg education on him, read all the Caesar books, went to dog training, did everything. And as a result, the dog that we adopted, which was a year and a half old when we got him, is great now. I mean, he had all kinds of emotional issues, things that he was afraid of that no dog should naturally be afraid of. He was obviously abused before we got him. And we have since rehabbed him, and he's great. I run him minimum 3 to 5 miles a day.
What breed is he, Steve? So we can picture this. What breed?
Oh, I'm sorry. He's a lab mix.
Okay.
And, you know, I mountain bike, and he runs next to me, and sometimes we've done as much as 15 miles in the woods.
Wow.
He runs, and that's where he gets his balance from. He's very happy once that happens.
And what kind of off behaviors was he exhibiting when you first got this dog?
He was afraid of basements, but he was not afraid to go upstairs in our house.
Okay.
He just wouldn't go downstairs. He didn't have a problem with stairs. He had a problem with my basement.
Right.
He had a problem with the deshedding tool that looks like a band or a belt. He was afraid of plastic bags.
Mm-hmm.
He was afraid of cars. And at this point in time, the only thing he's really afraid of is the sound of air escaping, like an aerosol can, or if you let air out of a tire on a bicycle, which I often do when I ride, terrifies him. And I just recently found out, like a week ago, that I think it came from a snake, because for the first time we found a snake, and he cowered and, you know, and all that stuff.
So there's some history, maybe some instinct there. Do you have a question for Kevin on your interaction with your dog?
Yes. I'm trying to get to that. We got a puppy a year ago, and the puppy, I have been doing all of the same things with the older dog as far as training, and I think I'm doing a pretty good job. But I've noticed in the last 6 months that the older dog is absolutely, beyond the shadow of a doubt, depressed when we're not running. And it could be before a run, it could be after a run, it could be when he doesn't get his run for a day or maybe two, but it doesn't matter. It seems like nothing I can do to get him back to his old self again. And I know that I'm extremely stressed because I'm working, and my fiance is extremely stressed because she's going to school and working, and we're trying to plan a wedding, and the emotional toll is definitely there. My question is, what can I do with the 2 to 3 hours a day I spend with my dog? What can I do more to get him back to the happy-go-lucky, well-balanced, exercised dog that he used to be, without designating any more time than I'm already doing, because I just don't
can't
have time.
Can't always get five miles in. We've just got a few seconds before the break. Give us a little bit, Kevin, and we'll try and come back to
you, Steve. I would guess that his puppy is a pretty happy, eager, go-lucky kind of guy, and therefore his older dog is flipping, becoming the mirror and becoming depressed to complement the happiness of the puppy. And he should be playing tug of war with his older dog to get it more into the hunt and having fun as part of the group team work.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the human-dog emotional connection with dog trainer Kevin Behan. His new book is Your Dog is Your Mirror, The Emotional Capacity of Our Dogs and Ourselves, insights won in a lifetime of working with and training dogs. His dad was one of the first professional dog trainers, career dog trainers in the country. Kevin grew up with it, is trained, worked with thousands of dogs, done a lot with aggressive dogs, police dogs, difficult dogs, and he's sharing his insights right here. Kevin, please stand by there in London. We're really spanning the globe this hour, reaching out right now to Boulder, Colorado, and Mark Beckhoff. He's a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder, a fellow in the Animal Behavior Society, author of The Animal Manifesto and The Emotional Lives of Animals. Mark Beckhoff, Professor Beckhoff, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Very interesting conversation.
Oh, good. What do you think of Kevin's deep focus on humans and dogs and the emotional connection? Does that make sense to you as an evolutionary biologist?
Yeah, it does. I mean, cutting through the chase, I think one of the reasons that we're so attracted to other animals is that emotions, I like to say, are like a social glue. They pull us together. You know, people tried to make pet rocks and robotic dogs, and they just didn't really cut it. And I think it's because of the shared emotions that we have between us and other animals, and, you know, especially between us and our companion dogs.
Well, I mean, Kevin's a trainer. You're a scientist. Mm-hmm. Does this really transfer? When we say emotion, is it something that works across species? Do dogs have emotions in the same sense that humans do? Do all mammals, let's say, or even beyond that, have emotion? Is it really there in every species?
Oh, yeah. I mean, among mammals, we all share the same structures in the brain in an area called the limbic system. There's this little almond-shaped group of neurons called the amygdala, and that's the basic root of emotions. So across mammals, for sure, there's the sharing. But more and more evidence is coming out, you know, that, like, very recently it was demonstrated that chickens show empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And the important thing about all these studies is that they're published in, you know, highly respected peer-reviewed professional journals. And I was just writing something this morning, you know, people talk about surprises, you know, mice show empathy, chickens show empathy. We're discovering different neurons in the brains of whales and dolphins that are the very basis for their emotional lives. As an evolutionary biologist, getting back to your question,
mm-hmm.
It's not surprising at all. The likes of Charles Darwin, you know, argued for what he called evolutionary continuity, where he basically said the differences among species were differences in degree rather than differences in kind. So they're, you know, when you translate that into everyday language, he's basically saying the differences among species are shades of gray, not black and white.
So when you get into the human-dog relationship, how far can you go with that? Kevin Behan, and I know you've read his book, and I've seen you say good things about it, but he's describing a kind of reflective relationship here, one playing off the other. You know, and many of our listeners respond to that quite well, but others, I mean, here's a tweet from Allie. She says, so because Dottie is a mess of a dog, I'm at heart a mess? I mean,
yeah.
Do you buy that formula?
Well, you know, I'm not sure where to go with that, and I'll admit that that's not...
Are you just afraid to? Are you just being polite or what?
No, I'm not being polite at all. People
okay.
know that. I mean, I'm a polite man.
Okay.
When it comes down to the emotional lives of animals, I'm pretty adamant. You know, I think what we're seeing is this kind of reflection, and there's a lot of variation, you know, through the day, but I would have to say on average, and probably more than average, there is this mirroring back and forth. I can recall situations with my own companion dogs where they were reading me really well when my father-in-law died. I mean, I didn't expect that they would understand that, but they
mm-hmm.
were really reading my emotional state. They were reading my gait, you know, my general demeanor.
Yep.
And I came into the house, and instead of Moses, this huge Malamute, jumping on me and wanting his Frisbee thrown, within almost imperceptible time, he saw Mark wasn't his normal joyous self. Came over and really consoled me.
Mm-hmm. But
I think that, you know, especially with dogs, we've got this long period of domestication during which humans and dogs, you know, wolves, I mean, a domesticated wolf is really a dog,
right,
formed this really tight bond. And when I talk about reading one another, it could be reading visual signals, it could be reading or hearing, you know, auditory signals or voice, but also olfaction and odor. You know, I think people are pretty convinced that the detection of cancer and impending heart attacks and strokes has to do with, you know, the change in odor, perhaps the sweat that a person is putting out. Mm. So what I always tell people, you know, like I said, I'm not a dog trainer, but I've lived with many dogs, is that the dogs are reading us like an open book, but we're also quite able to read them. And so I think there is this mirroring effect. And of course, in the brain, there are now these neurons called mirror neurons that really support that, you know, there is a neurological basis to empathy. And I think a lot of what Kevin's talking about is empathy.
What about what we ask of dogs? I know you, like Jane Goodall, have worked in ethology, mm-hmm. studying animal behavior. And with Jane Goodall, of course, famous for her work with apes in Africa, mm-hmm. You co-founded this Ethologist for Ethical Treatment of Animals, and you've also worked with the Captive Animals Protection Society, campaigning for an end to the use of animals in circuses.
Right.
Now, how different is that use in the circus from the pet dog at home?
Well, I'll tell you, it's a very difficult situation. I get asked all the time, do I think there should be pets or companion animals?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that in the best of all possible worlds, it's a wonderful reciprocal and positive relationship. And I think it really comes down to not a lot of abuse. You know, in other words, I've worked with veterans and their companion dogs, veterans who are suffering from PTSD, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's a really, really strong relationship there. And whereas some people would say, well, the dog really isn't able to be a dog, if you will. I mean, I think part of being a dog is working with humans as long as the dog has an enriched and full life. So the people I've worked with who have these companion service dogs, if you will, are sure that the dog gets out to the dog park every day and has a rich life. I think it's unrealistic to, you know, think that we're going to phase out companion animals or pets. And I think what we really need to do is just be much more responsible as human beings when we make that decision to take a companion animal into our lives.
Kevin Behan, I'm wondering, as Professor Beckhoff's speaking and as you've been speaking about just how far this emotional link goes, here's a question from one of our listeners. Addie says, how do you know if your dog loves you? So first, does that word apply? That's a pretty deep emotion. Let me put it to Kevin for a second,
sure.
Mark, if I may. I mean, how far does the emotion go? And what about Addie's question? How do you know if your dog loves you?
Well, what I tell my clients is, yes, your dog loves you. Your dog has to love you. It's like gravity. He has to love you. There's nothing you have to do to earn his love. He's loving by nature. But the rub, the misunderstanding, is that we don't understand that love does work in nature. It gets energy moving, and if something's standing in the way, then love runs it over, and that's the source of all problem behavior, not understanding how the nature of the dog evolved to do work. So being Irish, I'm able to take a lot of philosophical leaps, and I would say that the wolf chose man, and there's no place to become the dog, and there's no place a dog would rather be but with man. But it's incumbent on us to get the emotion moving. So I believe, yes, love is genuine, but it does work. And we have to understand the nature of love, therefore.
Let's go to Jean in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jean, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. This is a great show. I just wanted to talk a little bit about that whole emotional relationship mm-hmm. that you can have with a dog. And I've owned dogs my whole life, and right now I have a beautiful 6-year-old German Shepherd female who mm-hmm. She is just like the love of my life next to my husband. And my and her relationship with my husband is completely different from the relationship she has with me. And it took me a while to figure it out. My husband has a very domineering, I'm in control, okay. You do what I want, you right. do what I think.
So he's the dominance alpha guy with the dog.
Totally,
okay.
Totally.
Okay.
And when I tried that approach, she's like, yeah, that's a joke. you're not that. And so I had a lot of trouble getting her to do things that I needed her to do. Until I read a book about talking points or something about how dogs communicate.
Yep.
And I realized that they also communicate that way with humans. So I started doing more physical touching and holding and just, you know, nuzzling mm-hmm. or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And she has just turned around completely. The relationship that we have now is very strong. She does what I ask her to do, but it's not a domineering relationship.
So you've found another way. Would you describe it as a, I don't know, an emotional exchange yeah. rather than a dominance exchange?
Yes, yes. It's wonderful.
Kevin, what do you say? Yeah, Kevin.
What's being revealed here is the wife and the husband's varying relationship with emotion itself. And so the husband is more afraid of emotion, which is why he feels the need to dominate the dog, whereas the caller is speaking how she just emotionally aligned with the dog and understood innately the need for the dog for this touching to complete the bond, the physical connection. So I think that's a wonderful testimony to someone aligning with the way emotion works versus someone who's trying to control emotion out of order. Just out of sheer order.
Are you assuming in that one of these, that you know, her or her husband's relationship is better or worse with the dog? Are you judging the dominance relationship as...
Well, usually it's a pretty safe bet that the women are more inspired to look for the emotional solution and the men are more inspired to try to control emotion. I know it's true in my case, so I plead guilty.
So maybe Shirley in Cambridge. Shirley, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is actually in contrast to the previous callers.
Okay.
My significant other, he has what I think is an unhealthy codependence with my dog.
what do you mean?
They do everything together. No matter where we go, even if we're going to a restaurant, Chunk must come. Our Chunk, he's a mutt. He's a Rhodesian Ridgeback and Husky.
Yeah.
And he's the most adorable, loving dog. But no matter where we go, even if it's to the grocery store, the first thing he says is, okay, let's bring Chunk. And I just don't understand that. He can be on the computer, and Chunk will nudge him and say, okay, it's time to pet me. He gets turkey broth and fresh turkey to mix into his food because
nice.
Chunk likes that.
Right.
I mean, I feel that the dog is completely spoiled. Chunk doesn't do a lot of the things that he does with my other that he does with me. I have more control of the dog, and he listens a lot better. But it's just, I just don't think it's healthy.
Shirley, are you jealous of Chunk? Chunk's getting more of your man's time, or is that not the issue?
No, not at all. I don't understand it.
Right.
I don't understand how someone could be so attached to their dog. There's no separation. He and Chunk are one, period. No matter where we go,
yeah.
Chunk must come, no matter what he's doing.
We got it. Our time is short. What about it, Kevin Behan? Is such a thing as too much when it comes to emotional engagement with the dog?
There's never too much, but what it is, I think the word dependency is very apt here. And Chunk is her husband's means of putting his heart first. He's not putting his heart first in healthier ways, and so the dog is a vicarious way of doing it so that he doesn't feel selfish about doing things for the dog. It's a noble end. And so I would follow her counsel, and the husband should look for ways where he would assert his own desires straightforwardly and not use the dog as a vicarious way of doing so.
You think he's using the dog? I'm still not sure I get that. He's what's he doing?
He's not able to express his desires directly.
Mm-hmm.
And if he would do that more when it's apt to do it and healthful for him to do it, then he wouldn't feel the need to have the dog always come first.
Huh.
If he put his heart first, the dog would be happy to follow. The dog doesn't need that tending, which is what he shows with the other people in his life. He doesn't do that with them. But the husband's need is to use the dog to express his own. So he's vicariously projected into his dog, And doing for the dog is actually doing for himself indirectly.
Mark Beckhoff, you study animal behavior. We're animals, too.
Mm-hmm.
What's gained when we focus on this emotional relationship between these two species? What comes of it?
Well, I think it helps us and it helps them, and meaning them, you know, being other dogs. Once again, because of that strong reciprocity. I mean, when I've lived with many dogs, and I live in the mountains outside of Boulder, Colorado, and I've got bears and cougars coming right to my door, and I bond with them as closely as I do to all the dogs with whom I've lived. So it always surprises me as a scientist that, you know, people question the strength of emotions, and, you know, there's fewer and fewer skeptics now. There's great science showing that, you know, animals have very rich emotional lives. So once again, I think it comes down to the emotions being the social glue.
Even with bears and cougars, no problem?
Oh, sure. I mean, they're just wonderful social beings. I have a mother bear and her babies at my house, and watching them interact, you know, you talk about love. Well, I mean, I don't think humans should be the arbiters of which species love one another.
Maybe not.
I think other animals express these very close and enduring social bonds, you know, very strongly. I don't know. You know, I thought about what Kevin was just saying, and I've definitely lived with, you know, loving dogs. I think the mirroring for me is not so much, at least personally, my finding myself in the dogs with whom I've lived, because I've rescued dogs that are incredibly different. I think what it is that I can feel good for bringing a good life to an animal, and they feel good about having that good life. And that's how, for me, these bonds are shared and, you know, they're mirrored.
Mark Beckhoff in Boulder, Colorado. I'm afraid the time is up right there. The dogs are coming out here. A professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder, author of The Emotional Lives of Animals. Thank you so much for being with us. And Kevin Behan, author of Your Dog is Your Mirror, The Emotional Capacity of Our Dogs and Ourselves. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Tom. And it was great to hear from Dr. Beckhoff as well.
Listeners, enjoy your dogs. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.